Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
This is Deutschlandfunk Kultur, the German public radio, and this is our philosophy program Sein und Streit. And today I am delighted to have a very special guest. Lea Ippi is with me here in the studio in Berlin. Hello, Lea. Welcome Hello. To the program.
Thank you.
Lea Ippi is not someone who needs much introduction these days. She is a well-known and well-respected academic. She is a professor in political theory at the London School of Economics. She has, among other things, worked extensively on Enlightenment thought and especially Immanuel Kant. Her scholarly book, The Architectonic of Pure Reason, that came out in 2021, has been translated into German this year and published by Suhrkamp under the title Die Architektonik der Vernunft. But more than her academic work, I think it has been her philosophical memoir, Free, Coming of Age at the End of History, published in 2021 as well in English and in German in 2022, that has made her a household name far beyond just academic circles. It is the story of her own early life and her family history in the late years of communist Albania, and also a very philosophical reflection on the meaning of freedom. Lea Ippi is currently working on a sequel, I believe, or a prequel, that is a more in-depth look into her family history. But she is, of course, also pursuing her academic interests. And one of her current research projects deals with what she calls moral socialism. That is also the title of a series of three lectures that she will be giving in Berlin in the coming days, the so-called Benjamin Lectures. And I am delighted that she is willing to give us a little insight into this project here on our program already today. So, Lea, I must confess that for me, this reintroduction of the word socialism into normative political theory is somewhat alien. I do myself not ordinarily move in those circles that debate the comparative merits of capitalism and socialism at dinner time. So maybe just for us to sort of understand where you are coming from with this idea and where you're going with it, maybe I could just sort of ask the very big overarching question. If to understand something is to understand the question to which it is the answer, as Gadamer once wrote, to what question is the idea of moral socialism the answer?
The question is, what is wrong with capitalism? And the answer attempts to provide a critique of capitalism that starts with the moral question of what is it about the system under which we live that is globalized, extended in the whole world, and characterized by inequalities of wealth and power, both within capitalist states, but also between different states in the world, and an effort to think morally, to begin with, about why, what is undesirable about this model that structures our lives, that is there every day, that we are confronted with, and that shapes who we are, and in some ways impedes us from becoming what we want to be.
So it is, in a way, on the most basic level, it is a concept with which you endeavor to criticize the current situation, which I think we might all agree has many, many aspects that we can criticize. The question still is, why go back to this word of socialism that many associate with real socialist experiences of the 20th century and do not necessarily have positive associations with?
Yeah, and this is where the word moral does more work than the word socialism. It's in part an effort to recover from that socialist tradition a critique of capitalism, but also to develop it in a direction that attempts to learn from these historical failures of real-world socialist experiences, and in particular, state socialist experiences. And what moral socialism, as I understand it, tries to do is to think about how we can realize freedom globally, and to think about the socialist and the liberal tradition as characterized by a pursuit and by a common search for freedom, and then develops the socialist tradition in the direction of explaining why is it that a socialist model is more and better able to resolve some of the contradictions of globalized society than the current capitalist structures that we live under.
If you oppose socialism to capitalism, am I to understand that we are mainly speaking about the structures of the economies that sort of govern our nation states and our global trade? Where in this sort of dichotomy would you place democracy, which would be an alternative way of describing not all of sort of the world, but a large part of the Western world, as that's what we are striving to be sort of more or less fair democracies?
Yeah, it's just that I think that capitalism and democracy are not compatible. And so in a way, you might think of socialism also as a radical global democracy. And in some ways, I'm not desperate to defend the label if people understand it or have less problem with the label of radical global democracy. That's completely fine, as long as we highlight that, yes, a part of this effort to develop an alternative model is about rethinking ownership structures and rethinking asymmetries of access to ownership, both within, as I say, capitalist states, but also between states where there are huge power differentials that shape the way in which international institutions then condition the behavior of more vulnerable states within a global environment, and where the core capitalist countries benefit from these asymmetries of power and injustice to their own advantage, therefore creating patterns of unequal development, where it becomes very, very difficult for certain countries to exactly reconcile capitalism and democracy in the way in which advanced capitalist countries sometimes in some historical periods seem to have succeeded in doing so. And in some ways, this is exactly the challenge, is to say that if we want global democracy, it would be very hard to have global democracy with capitalism. And therefore, we need to look beyond these capitalist economic structures.
If I may, just one more question on the moral in moral socialism. How exactly is it to be understood? I mean, what makes your vision of socialism a moral one? Is it the humans that engage in it, or is it the structure of the society?
So the challenge for the moral socialists is to give a moral critique of capitalism in terms of highlighting the inconsistencies, the asymmetries, and the false promises and the kinds of illusions that freedom has and acquires under a capitalist system. So the critique of capitalism is in some ways departing from the orthodox Marxist analysis, which is grounded on an analysis of historical materialism and of historical conflict as generated purely by the material conditions of production. And where the moral question of the injustice of capitalism is in many ways considered irrelevant, because the argument is that these patterns of unequal, asymmetric development under capitalism will somehow generate the response by themselves. There is a sort of teleology of history that is presumed to do the work of explaining why is it that this superior structure will emerge. Now, I think that model is in some ways has been intellectually and politically discarded. And indeed, what we must recover from the failure of socialist societies is their inability to have guaranteed what we might call first-generation liberal freedoms. In other words, freedom of association, freedom of movement, freedom of thought. So any effort to recover socialism needs to make the moral question front, right, and center, needs to make it the core of the program in a way that explains in how a socialist society must guarantee all the liberal freedoms that a capitalist society promises to guarantee at the level of equality before the law, at the level of equal liberties, at the level of freedom of opinion, freedom of association, freedom of movement, and radicalize those freedoms in a way that expands them more consistently and makes them reachable by not just a handful of rich people in rich societies and by a handful of rich states in a global order, but by everyone.
So since you have already spoken about it, I think we need to talk a bit more about freedom as a reality and as an ideal. It is, of course, quite a central idea in your thought, and you have shown repeatedly in your work that all political promises of freedom from liberal capitalist states as well as from socialist ones have not been fulfilled. How should we think about true freedom, and what would it take to get there, not just in thought, but in reality?
So I think the first thing to say is that no theory, no single framework, and no individual intellectual can have the answer of what we need to do to realize freedom, because that would be paternalistic and in many ways would remove the freedom that it promises. all we can do is point out inconsistencies and ideological appropriations of freedom in the societies in which we live. And in that sense, my moral socialist conception starts with an idea of freedom that is found in the German idealist tradition, that is in part developed by Marx, but that I particularly identify in the work of Immanuel Kant, where we think of freedom as an element that is present in the moment of moral responsibility. And that is something that internally characterizes every human agent, but the external conditions of realization of which depend on the political and social framework within which that freedom is realized. So I call this freedom as moral agency. And it has an internal component, which is there, universal. It's part of what it means to be human, capable of thinking and acting in a moral direction. But it also has an external component that is failed to be realized in the capitalist structures under which we live, because those capitalist structures generate forms of heteronomy or forms of undermining this Kantian element of autonomy that is required for human being self-realization and self-development, and from which arise phenomena of alienation, of false consciousness, of ideological subordination, and which this gap between the freedom of the moral agent and the ideological appropriations of freedom in the world can explain and can be the foundation of a new social critique.
Now, I do understand where you go back to Kant in sort of developing an idea of freedom as moral agency. And yes, that does seem appropriate. But what it is, this idea of freedom, if only thought of on an individual level, is quite a rigorous moral requirement. It is not something human beings are necessarily very good at, this type of freedom. We tend to be somewhat passive, or more passive than Enlightenment philosophers would like us to be. So the question becomes, I think, if freedom is this quite hard to reach ideal of the self as a moral agent, which also means being responsible for your own actions and sort of being responsible for other people, and kind of, it's not just, you know, I can do whatever I want. It does require quite a lot more. I mean, what is your idea then? How would the human being achieve this type of freedom? It seems to be a philosopher's dream, but isn't it just a philosopher's dream?
Well, the starting point would be to say that this capacity for freedom is always there, even when we make the wrong decision. Indeed, what it means to take responsibility or to ascribe responsibility or to think about phenomena like guilt and blame, all of these ascriptions of agency that we make in everyday language are premised on our understanding and on the assumption that there is moral agent behind every human being, however flawed they are and however limited they are and however the circumstances in which they have to make these decisions are. Now, societies can make these articulations, these external realizations of freedom, more or less demanding, more or less possible, depending on, for example, what kind of educational structures we have, depending on what kind of possibilities for communication we have, depending on what kind of margins of articulation of democratic debate and exchange and reasonable disagreement between citizens we have. And my argument is that in capitalist societies that are driven by profit and where politicians' decisions are often shaped by businesses, by lobbying, by corporate influence, the Enlightenment understood in this ideal form becomes very, very difficult to realize, though not impossible, because if it was impossible, then we wouldn't have social critique and we wouldn't have the push and we wouldn't have the type of political activity that is required to make this exercise effective. So the process, I don't think the question of the human being isn't a question that can be answered by asking, you know, what is the nature of the human? Is it good or is it bad? Or is it likely or unlikely to realize certain things? Or are these projects more feasible or less feasible? The important starting point for me is to recognize the impulse, and that impulse then needs to be articulated politically, and in different societies will take different forms. But we need to start with this capacity for critique and this capacity for enlightenment that we all have. And indeed, I think this is how exactly Kant understood the Enlightenment when he said that the Enlightenment is the emergence from human beings' self-incurred immaturity. In other words, there's this active component to what it means to be enlightened, which is the desire, the search for this moral agent that is able to project their moral ends in a world that enables them to do that.
It's interesting because I myself, not being a very astute Marxist or not having read all of Marx's work and not being so strongly in these Marxist debates or in these socialism debates, was not aware of the extent to which there have been intellectual currents inside Marxism and inside sort of socialist thought that do hark back to Kant very strongly. And this is, of course, something that you also propagate, that there is, of course, in socialist thinking, an important element of Enlightenment thinking. We could even say that socialism is sort of the endeavor to fulfill the promises of Enlightenment. Now, this I find very interesting on two grounds. Well, first of all, because we have nowadays a left which has a tendency to criticize the Enlightenment. I'm sure we can get to that in a moment. But on the other hand, I also think that there is something inside, roughly speaking, left intellectual traditions, socialist thinking traditions, and Enlightenment traditions, which is a very optimistic view of the human. It is what you have just expressed. Now, I do understand that and I do appreciate it, but isn't there somehow the counter argument to that, counterposition to that is, well, look at humans, and we have quite a few millennia of experience with them, and you can say, of course, it's always social structures that sort of do not allow them to flourish. But at the same time, aren't they just a type of animal that tends to behave badly if allowed? And isn't the best way of dealing with them to just sort of have relatively rigorous and sometimes violent state institutions and regulations where we just sort of manage this imperfect animal that is the human? And isn't this one of sort of the major sort of differences in the waiting or in the imagination of the human? Can the human become better? The optimism about the human. This would connect Kantian Enlightenment to Marxism, but the counterposition, which would sort of be more conservative or liberal at some points, would say, no, this is just not possible. That's not what humans are.
It seems to me that this question can't really be resolved from first principles. What is the nature of the human? Because we have both elements and we have evidence of both elements. So we have, yes, evidence of human beings particularly nasty to each other in the course of human history. But we also have examples of structures of solidarity, and we have examples of moral heroes, and we have examples of movements that operate on very, very different principles. So if we just pose the question of what is the nature of the human, it's not a question that we can really answer if we concede that the nature of the human always changes, and it's also shaped and in part constrained by social structures. The danger of accepting the answer that says the humans are just wolves, and as in the Hobbesian picture, homo homini lupus, and that's all there is to say about it, is that then that justifies authoritarian structures, because then whoever is able to command and exercise power without really giving a moral reasons to, provided that they can guarantee compliance and order and maintain stability, there is no further question to be asked on the moral justification of these structures. What is it that makes them good, and why is it that they give more freedom to the person, to the agent, than if we didn't have these structures? So it seems to me that it's a slippery slope, the one that says let's forget about this notion of the human as a moral agent and as potentially improvable, and let's just accept that humans are what we have most evidence of, which is these bloodthirsty and rival and competitive beings. First, because as I say, that's historically false. Not all humans are like that. But second, that it seems to me politically it takes us into a very, very dangerous place and is the core of all fascist authoritarian structures, that type of justification.
So in a way, just from a philosopher's point of view, it is alternativlos, it is without alternative to believe in some degree that there is the possibility of moral agency in the human. Otherwise, you're just giving up on the whole project of making anything better at any time, right?
It's a possibility when it comes to the politics, but it's a reality when it comes to the capacity for reason. Mm-hmm. Because I think our capacity for reason is just there. Even the most flawed human being knows when they act wrongly that they have acted wrongly. There's something Kant would say about morality that shines through every person, even if then there are constraints that we need to account for. And then there are different theories of how is it that we can unearth the possibilities of the human.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we mentioned already, or as you mentioned already, there is sort of the connection between Kant and socialism is important to you, of Kant and Marx, basically. And you're not at all the first person who makes this connection. There is a long tradition that I was quite unaware of Marxist thinkers who did very explicitly hark back to Kant. And it's a German and Austrian sort of group of thinkers which are important to you. Can you say a little bit on that?
Yeah, the German socialist Hermann Cohen, mm-hmm. who was writing at the turn of the 20th century, indeed says that Immanuel Kant is the first founder of the German socialist tradition. And the engagement with Kant is, through Hegel in part, but also just Kant, is central to the beginnings of Marxist analysis. It's crucial to, for example, Marx's explanation or articulation of alienation under capitalism. There's a concept of the human being as an end-setting entity that is very reminiscent of the type of being capable of practical reason that Kant talks about. But then politically, with the so-called Second International, there are strands of reconciliation that attempt this reconciliation between Kant and Marx in German philosophy through, as I mentioned, Hermann Cohen, Staudinger, in Austrian circles through people like Otto Bauer and Adler and Karl Renner. The founder of German social democracy, Eduard Bernstein, was also a Kantian and very much inspired by this neo-Kantian thinking. They are very different between them. They have different political histories and different implications. The German school goes in a more reformist social democratic direction. The Austro-Marxists have a slightly different take, in part because they emerge out of this Habsburg context. But then I think there are also later on, both within more academic Kantian scholarship efforts that try to recover and to give an interpretation of Kant's philosophy that is not the standard analysis of Kant as a liberal philosopher, and that tries to explain the radical potential within his theory of practical reason, but also his political philosophy and his philosophy of right. There is later on, even within liberal circles, someone like John Rawls, for example, who is considered to be a liberal philosopher par excellence. There are many elements of John Rawls's thinking that are compatible with this effort to reconcile Kant and Marx, in particular when it comes to thinking about what is the most appropriate regime type for the realization of Rawls's principle of justice as fairness, where he says that actually neither laissez-faire capitalism nor welfare state capitalism are appropriate institutionalizations of his theory of justice, or where he gestures in the direction of what he calls property-owning democracy on the one hand and liberal socialism on the other. These are both kinds of societies with institutional implications that don't exist. They're not out there because they are societies that attempt to realize this conception of justice and fairness that was crucial to Rawls, where the justification is in many ways Kantian as well. So there, I think, both in the liberal political tradition, the more egalitarian liberal tradition, and within the history of Marxism, there are elements that suggest that these theories are more compatible than it looks.
It's interesting because nowadays we would tend to think of sort of left-wing intellectual endeavors as not being particularly in line with enlightenment for a variety of reasons, but one of them, of course, being a very strong criticism of the enlightenment in recent years as being an era that is not only brought out wonderful moral philosophy, but also colonialism and quite a lot of sort of bad history along with quite a lot of good thought. So how to bring these two things together, and they are often sort of amalgamated, and the thought and the history is thought of as one piece. How would you reconcile progressive thinking with this problem?
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate implication of a number of these post-colonial and postmodern critiques of the Enlightenment that they seem to throw out the baby with the bathwater, because it seems to me that a body of thought that happens to arise in parallel, in tandem with the emergence of liberal capitalist structures, is made responsible for phenomena that are actually the result of the expansion of capitalism to other countries from the core European states. And indeed, I would say that the problem is not that the Enlightenment is responsible for colonialism, but that colonialism is a phenomenon that gets asserted despite the Enlightenment, and indeed is an example of the difficulty of reconciling a liberal capitalist project with these principles of Enlightenment. And so I would say the problem is not that we have had the Enlightenment. The problem is that we haven't had enough Enlightenment and too much of the what comes with this model of assertive, expansive, expropriative capitalism, and where we really need to redirect our critiques, because if we are unable to recover the universalist tradition that is at the basis of social critique that can articulate all these different claims based on gender, on race, on workers' exploitation, then we are left with these fragmented struggles in which the identity of one group is as good as the identity on another group, but there is no project that is able to bring all these concerns and to explain how they come together and in what way we can engage productively with the conflicts that we all experience of globalization.
So we do need a universalist element there, a universalist project. And what would that be?
Well, the project is that of moral justification of the social structure in which these conflicts sit, and the ability to understand that social structure and the flaws, the moral flaws of that social structure, which then prevent a radical emancipatory project from being advanced, and where then the struggles between these different social groups are all pitted against each other. The struggle for a particular ethnic group is pitted against the struggle for gender rights, for example, or the struggle for the environment is considered to be in tension, whereas the capacity to bring all these different types of conflicts under the same effort to explain what is the basic justification of the social order that we have and in what way does that justification fail to match, to meet these moral requirements, would exactly enable us to advance in a more productive way.
Maybe if I may push you just one last time on what this project would look like in the real world, how could one put it in terms that, say, my grandmother might understand?
Let me think. I think everyone understands the injustices of capitalism. Everyone understands that we live under a capitalist system that is unable to deliver freedom for everyone. What we don't have is forms of political agency and movements in society that can articulate that critique and turn it into politics. And for that, I would say what we need is, first of all, to recover this universalist critique of capitalism that we have lost, because it got lost into the different identity struggles, each of which claims a part of their critique of capitalism, but is unable to put it all together. And then types of social movements and political agents, political parties that can coordinate with each other, not just within the state, but also at a European level, at a transnational level, with an agenda of change that tries to really overcome the system in which we live, as opposed to trying to adapt piecemeal by coming up with policies that accommodate us with these injustices. So I think what we need is basically a radical critique of capitalism as a system and a progressive alternative that articulates what this anti-capitalist vision should be like. And I think moral socialism is a contribution in that direction.
A revolution of our thinking that harks back to the Enlightenment. Lea Ippi, thank you so much for coming by the studio today. And for those who want a much more insight into what Lea Ippi is thinking about when she speaks about moral socialism, for those in Berlin at least, the opportunity arises in the coming few days from Wednesday to Friday of the coming week. She will be speaking about moral socialism in the Haus der Kultur und der Welt. This is the Benjamin Lectures organized by the Humboldt University in Berlin. Thank you, Lea, for coming by.
Thank you for having me.